Hi, and welcome everyone to twovisionmedia.org here tonight with me, Paul Stevenson. That is the new day and new time that I will be joining you weekly here on Revision Media. That is from 8 o'clock UK time through till 9. That is 3 p.m. till 4 p.m. Eastern time and 2 p.m. till 3 p.m. Central. So this will be my usual slot now going forward. It was previously on a Thursday, a bit later than that, a couple of hours later. So every Wednesday here at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, as I say, 2 p.m. Central and 8 till 9 p.m. Here in London, where I am. And very glad to be with you tonight. I have been a little bit under the weather, actually. I don't know whether it's flu or who knows, maybe it's the coronavirus. But I think it's probably more like a chest infection. But here's the thing. And this really does kind of highlight a big part of this problem when I'm going to get to this whole thing with coronavirus. I have been reluctant to phone up. We have a number over here, which, you know, when we basically flooded the country with about, you know, 8 million immigrants in the space of 20 years, people realized that, and the government realized that it was hard to go to your normal GP to get a doctor appointment without having to wait for about 6 weeks. That's not an exaggeration. It got to the point, especially if you're in a place like London, where you could ring your local GP, ask for an appointment, and, you know, if I was to ring today, you would get sometime probably at the beginning of November. This has been, I'm already digressing, but this has been a bit of a phenomenon over here. It's one of the reasons why people voted for Brexit as well, because we had a lot of the ex-communist countries, the Eastern European countries coming over here. You've got all sorts of entitlements as well, including the NHS, which obviously the NHS was something that was created for British people to pay into with their taxes so that when they needed to use it, they could. Obviously, people coming here from Eastern Europe couldn't possibly... first of all, they haven't put anything into it, and secondly, they couldn't possibly, because a lot of, you know, pay catch up in terms of their taxes, because so many of the type of jobs that the people from Eastern Europe do when they get here are working in cafes and you know, the big Tescos and, you know, smaller type jobs where they couldn't possibly pay taxes, you know, to actually, you know, put in enough to cover what they would take out in public services like the NHS particularly. This is another reason, as I say, why people voted for Brexit, to stop the flood of people. And it's another story completely what's been happening down in Dover. We've had a flood of immigrants coming in. Of course, the Marxists and the fifth column in the country, including the Home Office, Priti Patel. She herself, of course, is an African immigrant. It's not her culture. It's not her heritage. It's no coincidence these people find themselves in these high up positions in the higher echelons of government and our institutions, because they are not. Sadiq Khan is another little scumbag who fits this criteria perfectly, and we can see the fruits of what he's been doing in London, commissioning, you know, having a look at what statues we have and what name, what roads, or, you know, the names of the roads that we have, and having a look and, you know, seeing if we can update these to fit in with our diverse society. This is the reality of multiculturalism. That's why I hate it, because it by definition it will always be a threat to the native population, because every country has a native population and a native culture and a native ethnicity. And if you introduce different groups of people from around the world and you have this multicultural society, automatically you're going to have a threat to the indigenous culture. But anyway, Priti Patel is and Sadiq Khan embody this phenomena of politicians who are from different parts of the world, whether they're, you know, they're quite often, I mean, our political institutions are full now with, you know, Rishi Sunak, a guy I'd never known about, never heard of, up until, you know, 6 months ago, became the essentially the equivalent of the Treasury Secretary over here, the Chancellor. And he gets to decide, you know, who gets what money and how we pay for it and everything else. But, you know, again, he's a foreigner, Indian guy, and he's a Hindu, I think, also. So is Priti Patel, the Home Secretary, who would be responsible for things like immigration, Sadiq Khan. It's not their culture. It's not their heritage. They're not interested in maintaining it or seeing it go into the future or protecting it. And they really, at best, they are indifferent. At worst, they're probably harboring some, you know, either Marxist aspirations to destroy the place, or, I don't know, some sort of hostility towards the British for British imperialism. Who knows? I think, you know, a lot of these times these people are just scumbags. They would probably sell their own mothers for political gain and power. But totally digress. But the point is, immigration has been a big problem. We've seen it, you know, the demographic shifts over the years. Staggeringly, frighteningly large demographic shifts in and the sheer scale of it in such a short period of time is to call it disconcerting is the understatement of the year. But as a result of this, one of the reasons that you don't go to the doctor so often, they have a number called 111. So you ring up and you can kind of, it's like a kind of a mixture of having a GP appointment and have an emergency appointment where you'd go up to the hospitals. Well, you would sort of bypass your GP. You'd go up to the hospital and there might be some doctor or even a nurse up there who might be able to help you out. So with all this coronavirus going on, when you've got a, like the sort of symptoms I have of flu and I suspect that I might have a chest infection, which I would need an antibiotic for. Normally I would call 111. I'd drive up there. I'd go through it, and it's usually, and in fairness to them, it's usually a decent service, and it usually works pretty well. And I don't want to do that now because, you know, they might say, well, you know, these are coronavirus symptoms. And if I test positive for coronavirus, okay, you've got to self-isolate for 2 weeks. And if I have to self-isolate for 2 weeks, I lose my job because I don't work for some big company or some government job which adds nothing to society, to put it mildly, and just takes and drains the taxpayer to pay, because the big government's expensive. So I don't work for one of these big government jobs and departments, a list of which is just always increasing. I'm not working for a company where I can just say, listen, I'm off sick, I'm not covered. I work for a small business, and if I don't work, I don't get paid. In addition to that, these new rules that have been brought in here, these heavily draconian rules by which Boris Johnson, the perceived libertarian, should be utterly ashamed of himself. This is a guy who likes to talk about Churchill as his role model. I mean, this guy is a complete and utter moron. And that's the nicest word I can think about it. The nicest thing I can call him in light of his new draconian laws that have been brought in here. One of which is, if you are self-isolating and you leave home, you can be fined £1,000. And if you do it again, you can be fined £10,000. And I mean, this is how severe it's getting now, but the good news is, on some level, people are getting sick of it. But, of course, if you've ever been listening to this show, and those of you who do, right from the start, people who've been informed have realized this thing's been over-amplified and over-egged from the start, and that it's got a lot less to do with, you know, governments protecting us, and a lot more to do with economic shenanigans and nefarious activities and restricting our freedoms. And what's happening at the minute, there's absolutely, my narrative, like a lot of people who are informed's narrative, was there is no justification for shutting down the whole economy based on the deaths that COVID produced back in the early days. Now no one's even dying. The numbers are tiny and they're still continuing it. You know, and I remember saying this, and I said it to my church as well. Why people should push back? Because if you don't push back at the start, they're going to take more ground, and you're weaker, and they're going to get stronger, and they just take more ground all the time. Once these guys have these powers, they're not going to want to give them up. Now we have a vote over here. It's called the emergency powers, the coronavirus emergency powers bill, which will be due for review on the 30th of September. And these are this is the bill that was pushed through that allowed the government, essentially, some of it anyway, to basically act like a dictatorship with all these edicts and fines. And they're even talking about bringing the military in, which has really upset a lot of people. I mean, this is just absurd. But, and this is at a time, and for what? Because no one's even dying. And because it's all based on cases. So I think they're building up to justify, apart from, you know, conditioning people and throwing their weight around, which is what governments like to do. I think they're building up to this bill being voted on again on the 30th of September to try and justify and try to extend their powers. And I fully expect that bill to be extended, despite the fact that the public mood has changed. Because people are aware that no one's dying anymore, and these are just cases. Most of the cases, the small number of deaths are again, 95% of people who are really old, have other pre-existing health conditions. And people are aware of this. The numbers are really small in terms of deaths, and in terms of the cases, the majority of the people just have no symptoms, or they have very mild symptoms. In other words, this is way down the scale now in terms of a threat, you know, where, you know, cancer, more people are dying of easily, and probably it'll materialize as a result of not having cancer scans and treatments and other serious operations and illnesses that people had will ultimately dwarf this. So people are starting to realize something's not right here. And I think that if some good comes out of this is that people grow up. Because one of the biggest threats that we face, I believe, is apparently intelligent people always giving the benefit of the doubt to governments year after year, decade after decade of incompetence. And then you look at something like this and people look, listen, even before this happened, just on the original death toll, people look and think, this is really no worse than flu. How can this be justified? And then people start thinking, is there a conspiracy here? Because people, as I say, it's one of the biggest threats, I believe, to a free society that we face, is that so many apparently intelligent people who would consider themselves adults will not, and to my mind, to the point of bigotry and absolutely closed-mindedness, will not entertain the idea of conspiracy, will not look beyond incompetency. Will not look at reality that you could teach your 10-year-old child whose mind is like a sponge and open to information and reality and facts, that the world and our governments do not have our best interests at heart. And it's laughable that some of the, including some of these, and I think these are the ones that really annoy me the most, these centrists who consider them, you know, they consider themselves sort of persecuted, I suppose, you know, by the far left. But I mean, the far left are so far left these days that anybody is right wing compared to these people. But the centrist like Farage, who would consider himself a libertarian and a right wing guy or whatever, you know, first of all, they're always going out of their way to qualify everything that they're not racist, but whatever. Every conversation where they're accused of being racist, they're so scared of this term being called racist. And the other thing is, as I say, these types of people, they have to be dragged to conspiracy, to reality. I remember whenever the Brexit thing was going on, with Theresa May was over there, I was like, you know, doing it week after week on my show, saying this is not incompetency, this is collusion, it's corruption, it's conspiracy. She's over there, she's part of a fifth column in the country. It took Nigel Farage who is a real proper Brexit guy, about a year and a half to even entertain the idea that this woman is not even trying to get a date. And so it is with this coronavirus thing. When I was saying at the start, and people like me, you know, people with much bigger platforms than I do and are much more influential than I do and know a lot more than I do, no doubt, were saying that this was a farce from the start, that this is, there was no justification for a lockdown. These guys thought, and they would consider themselves conservatives and libertarians and everything else, they thought it was okay to lock down the whole the country and to run up the national debt by billions. And they're still talking about it. These people are talking because we're into this new kind of almost full lockdown. Oh, well, we've got all these people on furlough, and these people weren't going to, they're not going to have their jobs. And so now you've just locked them down again. So what are you going to do? Well, what were they going to do anyway? The only reason that they're on furlough, or that they're even on their employer's list of employees, is because the government is paying them, and the companies are being paid to keep the workers on their books. But as soon as they stop the furlough, those people are not going to be on their books anymore, because the jobs aren't there, because the economy is destroyed. So now they're talking about, you know, extending this economic insanity, and they're talking about, well, this is not, it's not their fault, and are we going to have a, we need more stimulus, we need more furloughs. Furloughs for what? Furloughs for jobs that were long gone, you know, even weeks ago. And you've had the likes of Farage and some of these, you know, St. Douglas Murray and some of these guys. I mean, they've even Fox News and guys like that, you know, they have justified this to a large extent. They think, oh, well, you know, we've had a crisis and it's nobody's fault. And, the, you know, and we've all had to deal with it. Excuse me. That's nonsense. People don't have any savings anymore because we live in an economy which is just full of debt. Everyone's over leveraged with debt. And to even think, oh, you know, it's just accepted that, well, there's nothing we could have done about it. Well, actually there is. People used to have savings so they could ride it out. Notwithstanding, you know, the whole idea again, you know, at the start, no one was blaming the government. They're blaming the coronavirus. Now they're starting to blame the government because there's no deaths. But they should never have blamed the coronavirus in the first place. They should have always laid the blame at the feet of the government for causing the economic carnage. Instead of thinking Rishi Sunak is some hero. The guy's straight out of one of the Rothschilds' banking houses. What a surprise. Same as that little weasel over in France, the president over there, not a Rothschild boy, Macron. Absolute puppets. And so, as I say, neither saying, well, the government's, you know, you've brought these new measures in now where, you know, you're telling people not to go to work anymore and to work from home if they can. You've got to be able to continue the furlough. Who pays for it? Government's broke. And they're even more broke now, and they're even more in debt now than they were 6 months ago, to put it mildly. And we've got a much smaller tax base to make up the deficit. Where does the government get money from? From taxing the citizenry, who have to work for it, that they borrow from the Bank of England, just like you do over there in the Federal Reserve, who creates the money on a laptop or a tablet, or they could create on a smartphone. 0000000000 enter. It makes a complete mockery of labor and economics. They create it out of nothing, and then people have to work hard, create businesses, goods and services, their labor, to pay that back. And people think that somehow, you know, the Chancellor has been so kind and that he's got the power to do this. Yeah, because he's part of a criminal syndicate is why he's got the power to do this. And it's just the ignorance is just so annoying sometimes. And there was even some economic expert guy on today talking about this type of thing. You know, well, we need some temporary measures. We've got to get through the woods. And then after that, we can look at it. But, we're going to have to probably raise taxes at some point. Probably. Yeah. Anyway. But, the key point is that if the jobs are lost and the companies, in reality, as soon as the furlough would stop, those companies, some of them are not even going to be there, but those companies would lay those people off straight away simply because they don't need them, because they don't have the business to cover their jobs. Their jobs are fake. So essentially the taxpayer is on the hook now, and they're talking about, continuing this to keep people on salaries and wages, or 80% of them anyway, that don't exist, that disappeared long ago. Just, you may as well just put, go in the dole and pay them their wages and be honest about it and say, okay, we're just going to pay you this as, as welfare. But the whole idea of like paying 80% of someone's wages, when their jobs, as soon as the government stops doing it, their jobs are gone. They don't exist. It's a nonsense. Anyway, so I'm going to play a clip by, because this is the whole point of these cases. And, and thankfully people are pushing back on this now. There's a lot of anger in this country now after the new measures that Boris Johnson announced last night. And talk about, I don't know, Boris Johnson, some of us thought we could give him the benefit of the doubt that he might do something. And this is before the coronavirus thing. He has just been a total puppet in all this completely. So, and we shouldn't be surprised, but some people are a bit disappointed and sad about it. But no, we're not one bit surprised. He's just another little puppet. By the way, if anybody wants to phone in, the number, I'll just give it out a second. It's 001 is obviously if you're calling outside the UK or from the United States. From within the United States, where most of you are, the number is 845, if I'm correct. 855-492-6049. That's 855-492-6049. Call in. It'd be great to hear from you if you have any comments, questions. So that's 855-492-6049. Johnson announced his it was hard to listen to. It really was. It's hard. It's insulting, really. And I think a lot of people do feel insulted. And I looked at the likes and dislikes, whenever on various media, the Evening Standard, BBC, The Guardian had their own little YouTube clips, a couple of minutes or whatever, pointing this out or covering Johnson's latest address to the nation, like it's some emergency. And there was a lot of anger. There was a hell of a lot of dislikes. So it's good that finally the country's waking up. It's a shame they had to be duped to the point that they allowed the government to get these powers in the first place and for them to have done the damage to the economy anyway. Because this would be like, the economy's done anyway. It's just like literally sort of just about breathing. It's just like a life support machine. And these latest measures of the government, it's just like someone coming in and just like, okay, that's pulling the plug on it. That's what that's like. It's an awful shame what's happened, really, to so many countries around the world who are experiencing the same thing. But it seems that we're almost worse over here in the UK than anywhere.
Find its way through to the elderly as well. To those who say,
now listen to this utter BS.
Those who say, we don't need this stuff, and we should leave people to take their own risks. I say these risks are not our own. Tragedy.
Here's the psyops, and I've spoken about this before. The government are pitting the people against the people. And essentially, this is communism, because it's a collective mindset where and this is the guy who calls himself a libertarian. It's a mindset that the Chinese at least admit and say this is how they operate, but we pretend over here that we're some sort of, you know, free parliamentary democracy. Democracy is a pile of nonsense because it's so easily manipulated into tyranny. That's one of the problems with it. And Johnson here now is basically selling collectivism to us, and it is a psyops where it's pitting people against the people, where it's like you're not responsible for yourself because someone else might be in trouble. But you could say that about anything. You could say it about driving, you know, 50 miles an hour in a 30 mile an hour zone. You could literally say about anything. Anybody's behavior could adversely affect someone else's behavior. And what? Should we just like penalize the whole society and make us all like robots? Because that's where this is going. It's pressurizing people to behave in a certain way for the collective good.
And to those who say we don't need this stuff and we should leave people to take their own risks, I say these risks are not our own. The tragic reality of
these risks are not our own. These risks are not our own. That's exactly what they are in a free society. They're our own risks. And everybody should look after themselves and do whatever they need to do. Hide themselves in their wardrobes for the next 6 years if they're so scared and they feel that's what they need to do. And let, you know, everybody else get on with things. But this whole idea of shutting down the whole economy and fracturing society like they're doing for the fact that some old people and vulnerable people, and who are not even dying anymore, that's the thing. But even when they were, it's not an excuse. Now they're not even dying. And we'll get to the whole nonsense about cases in a minute and about what the evidence is for these cases is in a second.
Is that your mild cough could be someone else's death knell. And as for the suggestion that we should simply lock up the elderly and the vulnerable with all the suffering that would entail, I must tell you that this is just not realistic. Because if you let the virus rip through the rest of the population, it would inevitably find its way through to the elderly as well, and in much greater numbers.
That is just utter bullshit, but I haven't got time.
We need to suppress the virus now. And as for that minority who may continue to flout the rules, we will enforce those rules with tougher penalties and fines of up to £10,000. We will put more police out on the streets and use the army to backfill if necessary.
Use the army? So, am I hearing things? What the hell? I mean, this guy's gone completely crazy. This is one of the biggest things that people were complaining about today and just shocked about. We will use the army. If these guys, what it demonstrates is the government can soon move when it's in their interests or when they think it's in their interest. What about it deploying the army to Dover to stop an invasion? Invasions that happen in dinghies. What about deploying the army down there to stop the third world continuing to flood in here, Boris? This is just intolerable. This is unacceptable. I mean, this is an overreach beyond what is should be even remotely acceptable. And there needs to be, this cannot be allowed to continue, and there needs to be consequences for that, because this is a tipping point of audacity.
Of course, I'm deeply spiritually reluctant to make any of these impositions or infringe anyone's freedom. But unless we take action, the risk is that we will have to go for tougher measures later when the deaths have already mounted.
All right, enough of that. Shut your mouth. I can't listen to it anymore. You get the picture. It's hard to listen to. It really is infuriating. I'm going to play. There's a guy called Dr. Mike Yeadon, and he's the chief science officer for Pfizer. And he basically said that the second wave has been faked on these positive tests, and that they're completely these positive cases are false positives, for the most part, he said. And you know, again, this is a sort of the, in quotes, science that is producing the excuse for all this nonsense. So this was on talk radio, Dr. Mike Eden. In fact, I was watching the Liberty Report, Ron Paul's channel earlier, and he was covering this story. It was about a couple of days ago on talk radio, the 21st of September it came out. Julia Hartley Brewer is another one who doesn't believe in conspiracy theories, but you can see these people sort of like gradually coming around to our way of thinking, even if they'll like kind of stop short of anything really controversial, like, you know, that maybe vaccines aren't such a good thing. They, you know, they get into tinfoil hats, insults and pejoratives at that point. But this is shifting the consciousness of people that, well, what the hell is going on here? You know, how can this be, you know, if they couldn't see that it was, that there was no justification for it with the first lockdown, when they start talking about armies on the streets and £10,000 fines and, you know, and essentially having another lockdown in many ways for all intents and purposes when it comes to so many people's livelihoods and businesses based on cases. And people like this lady, Julia Hartley Brewer, who are interviewing this guy, and he said that the tests are false positives. Any intelligent mind must start entertaining the idea of conspiracy and nefarious intentions by the government. And the sooner the people wake up to this idea, the better. I'll just fix the volume. It's a bit low.
Let's talk to my first guest of this hour. That's Dr. Mike Eden. We've spoken to him a couple of times already on the show since the pandemic. He's the former chief scientific advisor with Pfizer. And he has identified for us a number of issues with the testing regime. Now, Mike, when we've spoken before, the big thing that lots of people are asking the government about, and I saw this on all the Sunday shows again, is how many people are getting tested? Why aren't we doing more about providing more tests? Why can't people get tests if they're they're asymptomatic, because we know about the spread of all that and all the different issues? But the issue that you've been raising, and it's something that Carl Hennigan at Oxford University has been raising, is whether or not these tests are even worth the paper they're printed on. And last week, Matt Hancock told me that the false positive rate for these tests was below one. And he said that was a nice low rate and that was a good thing. You're very concerned and have written a piece over the weekend to point out that he's quite wrong about that, isn't he?
Yes, good morning. Good morning to you. Yes, I'm afraid he is completely wrong about his view that there is no problem at all. So it's important just to explain what do we mean by false positive, because I think the health sector has got the wrong definition. The real definition of false positive is what percentage of the entire population that you are sampling in pillar two screening, what percentage come up as positive. Now, he said it was just below 1%, and lines of evidence say we think he meant probably 0.8. There's all sorts of reasons why he meant that. So if you have 10,000 patients being screened, it's 0.8 of those, or 80, that will come up as false positive. And I think he thinks it's the percentage positive.
Now, Mike, apologies. We've got a little bit of a problem. Mike, can I stop you a second? Because we've got a bit of a problem with your line. We've got a little bit of a cutting in and out. But I say, let me just go. The key point here is that the impression you got from the interview we did with Matt Hancock was that he thought that because the false positive rate is below 1%, that means that below 1% of the cases that come up positive are false, and you're saying no, it's not. It's 1% of all those who you test, or 0.8% probably of who you test. And given that we have such a tiny, tiny number of people who are testing positive, around the same number, it means that something like in the region of 9 out of 10 of the tests that are coming up positive, people are told you have COVID, may not actually have COVID at all.
Yes, you said it exactly correctly. So another way to say it is, if the false positive rate, the fraction of your tests that come up positive, though they do not have the virus, if that's greater than what's called the prevalence, the fraction of people who've got the virus, it doesn't matter how hard you try, you can't subtract it. You will end up with most of your positives being what are called false positives. They don't have the virus, they're not sick, they won't get sick, not contagious. And you may have noticed, Julia, and that's possibly why I was thinking about this for the last few weeks. Have you noticed that when we get so-called surges or peaks, in Leicester and so on, almost no one was ill? And that figures now, because I think between 5 times and 10 times the number only 1/5 or 1/10 actually have the virus. These are the ones that are true positives. And so the problem is, if the false positive rate is higher than the prevalence, you cannot use the assay. There's nothing you can do to fix it. And I believe, let me just finish this one sentence. It may sound controversial, but unless they can fix this assay, I believe they should stop pillar two testing, because there isn't an assay that can do other than I have described to generate mostly false positives.
So this isn't that this is a peculiarly poor test. It's just this kind of testing in the community. And this is the big difference between testing in hospital and testing in the community. Testing in hospital we call pillar one testing, in the community pillar two. Now, when you're doing pillar one, you're testing people who are already ill. They've got symptoms, and you're doing testing with medical professionals taking the test, and they're going straight to the lab. And that, of course, has a much higher rate of reliability than a test done by non-medically trained people in the community of, to a certain extent, a fairly random sample of people, because a lot of people are going to get tested who haven't got symptoms themselves. They may think they've been in contact with someone who thinks they've got COVID. Again, odds are they haven't got it. So it's the number of people and the reason why they're being tested that's also the issue.
Yes, you said it right. So the pillar one test in hospital, certainly just to take us back to that ghastly month of March, where we're at the peak of infections, and then in April, about April 10th, we saw the peak of deaths, and then for the last 6 months, it's fallen continuously. But back in March, I've looked at the data, and fully 30% of the people who were sampled were positive. So now it's 30% who are positive, and then 0.1, 0.8% who are false positive. Basically, the effect there is, instead of 30 out of 100 being positive, and they do have the virus, you get 31. There's that one. So you can see now the effect of false positives is irrelevant.
Yeah.
But now, when there's almost no one who's got it, an average member of the society, of the public, ONS says it's about 0.1%, one in a thousand. 0.8% is this fixed false positive rate. It's generating 5 to 10 times more false positives than real ones. And earlier in the summer, it was 20 times. So it's got to stop. They must not use this assay. It's producing catastrophizing. And also an important point, Julie, if I was right and the government said, you know, Mike Eden's right, Carl Hennigan's right, let's just pull this test. There's nothing else actually happening of any great note. Yes, there are some in hospital. Yes, there are some dying. But as compared with the thousands dying every day, we're down to about 1% of that. And there actually isn't any fear that the government could provide. So it crosses my mind, I don't know why, I'm not making a conspiracy, but if they wanted us to be fearful, the best way to do it is carry on using a test that produces mostly false positives, because wherever they travel, that's what they'll get.
And this is the thing, and the more testing you do, the more false positives you'll get. In fact, you'll make it more likely there will be more. But with 3,899 cases yesterday, we've been around at 3,000 mark, now the 4,000 mark, the number is going up. But we do know that the proportion of positive cases of those tested is also going up. So there is a greater incidence, we think, of the virus in the community. And we have seen hospitalizations go up, and we have seen deaths go up. But Professor Carl Hennigan at Oxford University was saying yesterday, and in an article and on television, that this is the normal seasonal effect of getting in heading into September. There is a fear that we are catastrophizing normal seasonal trends. More people will die of flu, more people will die of pneumonia, more people will get colds, more people will get COVID. That doesn't necessarily mean we're entering a second wave.
Yes, absolutely. That's absolutely right. I've tried to explain to people, and if people are listening to this and want to know more of the background, it's my new article in Toby Young's Lockdown Skeptics. I'm not a lockdown skeptic the first time, I have been subsequent. I think it's a dangerous, damaging intervention that cuts across people's lives. And worse, it doesn't actually stop people catching the virus, they just get it later. So I don't think it saves a single life, but it deprives us of access to the NHS. Everybody knows that NHS access, they're trying their best, but they've been told for some reason to keep the loading of patients light. Seriously, this is my first claim, and it's true. They're keeping the loading on the NHS light, which is why you can't get the treatments and surgeries yeah. you want, because they're planning for a second wave. Julia, if you just give me 5 seconds, request to Matthew Hancock and to Professor Ferguson. So if you believe there's going to be a second wave, then you must have evidence for that. What is the underlying evidence that you're resting your case on? Because you seem to think there'll be one, and you're planning for it, and you're depriving us of the NHS, and you're prepared to lock us down to avoid it. But I've looked, and there's no evidence in the literature whatever. And as Carl Hennigan says, we're definitely not in a second wave at the moment. When you look at the data, honestly, there are more cases, but for the reasons Carl Hennigan said, I think at most we're in a second ripple.
Okay, thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Mike Eden, former Chief Scientific Advisor with Pfizer, looking at those figures. Really appreciate you joining us. A quick word from Benjamin Butler, listening to all.
So he finished there by saying, at worst, we're at a second ripple. So it's more like a second rip-off. So I think the government are probably realizing that they are indulging here in pathological levels of audacity, and they are taking the piss, as we say over here. Hence why they're mentioning the military, because they might need the military to police this. Because it's just a complete and utter obvious farce. It is to the majority of the population anyway. It's staggering that somehow 47%, there's a poll done that, you know, that do agree with the government's measures. But I think a lot of that's because of people on furlough, and they're hoping that they can continue their summer holiday, and that Rishi Sunak will extend the furlough. There's a lot of bribing going on by the government as well. Essentially, these are bribes in many ways. This furlough thing, you know, we'll lock you down, we'll lock the economy, but we'll give you money. We'll give you money that we haven't gotten, then collect it off the taxpayer later on down the line. I mean, I think some of those people are voting for it because they can stay at home. They like working from home, and you know, that type of thing. but here is in addition to that, sadly, there are people who are just completely and utterly brain dead, ignorant fools who just believe that if it's on BBC News, it doesn't matter how many other leading epidemiologists and professors and respected clinicians who completely dispel and destroy the arguments, in quotes, the insults made by Matt Hancock and our scientific experts. Some people will just never question that. Because they're just completely and utterly hopelessly plugged into a system, or products of a system, and it is literally beyond them to do any thinking for themselves. So I think that makes up part of that percentage of people who are actually supporting the government in this. Carl Hennigan is a very respected doctor over here, and he was mentioned in that clip, and I'm going to play a clip from him as well, so you can hear it from the horse's mouth. Because he also has rubbished the government's theater and pantomime around this. It was the weakest argument. I mean, this was weaker than weapons of mass destruction to, you know, with Tony Blair's BS to go to war in Iraq. And, you know, it's the same play, but, well, we've got to do what we've got to do just in case. We can worry about it later, because they always get it done first. They get it done what they want to do first, and then they worry about it later. Oh, sorry, there was no weapons of mass destruction. Well, who knew, eh? Oh, we thought at the time, though, we you know, it's the same thing today. Oh, we got it from our special intelligence sources. And now they're saying, well, we got it from our special scientific advisors that we should do this. Okay, we got it badly wrong, as if they somehow made a mistake. I mean, well, they're only acting in the best of the public interest at the time. But here's the thing. With the Iraq war, evil and as horrible as that was, for the people in this country and the people in America, it was way over there. It was over in the Middle East. It wasn't really affecting people at home so much. Not so much. It did as well with the restrictions of freedoms that were brought in and things like the Patriot Act, and we had similar things over here. But ultimately, the real devastation was felt out in the Middle East, fighting wars for Israel. But this is a different ballgame. This has destroyed people's livelihoods and people's civil liberties in a way that was unthinkable a year ago. And it terrifies me to think where this country's going if people accept this. Because we are in real trouble. This client's talking about bringing in the military and stuff like that to police this. And these are the same clowns who talk about, well, we fought World War II so we could defeat that evil Adolf Hitler, so we can live in a free society. And criticize Adolf Hitler for exactly the sort of thing they're doing now. And they'll criticize Vladimir Putin today as if he's some sort of evil despot. And Orban in Hungary. And they're such hypocrites. Because we just do the same thing in our so-called democracies. We have to just play a game where we indulge in democratic libertarian leisure domain. We have to keep an illusion going, the facade going that it's a democracy. So then we have to use things like the coronavirus and wars. Don't make no mistake about it. These guys criticize Adolf Hitler, Stalin. Well, they don't really criticize Stalin so much. But for what they accuse Adolf Hitler of, and Putin and Orban and all these guys, they are way worse. They just don't admit it. Which makes them worse, in my book. So here is Professor Karen Hennigan. The government is not talking to the likes of this fellow when they could do. And people are starting to obviously become aware that the government seem hell-bent on having lockdowns and these restrictions, regardless of the fact that there's zero justification for it. And the truth's coming out. Social media is a powerful thing. YouTube, BitChute, you know, shows like this. Shows like, by the way, you know, on RBN, do tune into RBN. There's some fantastic hosts there. Tune in there on a Monday with myself and Richard Carey on Beyond the Official Narrative, which is on RBN on Mondays at midday Central Time, 6 p.m. here in the UK where I am. That's RBN, Republic Broadcasting Network. Tune in there for good content and some great guests on there as well. So that's Mondays on Republic Broadcasting Network. You can tune into Richard there every night, Monday to Friday at the same time, midday for an hour as well. Richard always got great guests on. So the information is getting out there because of the internet. So now you're having this phenomenon where the government just have to exercise more power to police it, to control it, because they know. They know that we know that this is BS. And the higher up it goes, those who Boris Johnson work for, they know that we know it's BS. They know that we know what's going on. And that's why they have to censor YouTube and censor us all and clamp down, because they know that they can't deceive us all. They're not even deceiving half of us anymore. And people can work it out when you've got one of the most respected clinicians and doctors in this country, and Professor Karen Hennigan of Oxford University. He's not been consulted by the government. Government's apparently only interested in a couple of guys who say, oh, this is really bad, and we need to have a lockdown, and we need to infringe aggressively on people's civil liberties. That's the kind of doctors and experts they like. Not the one in this clip.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I'll try and do this and try and keep it. Let's try and keep it nice and clear. So, you've got two distinct, different testing strategies that were going on in August. You had the government one, which is the detected cases, and they were running at about 1,000 through August. The ONS data at the same time was suggesting actually there's about four times as many people in the background. That's the random sample. So one of the key issues is that whatever you detect is a function of who come forward. What we saw was in the detectable cases on the 2nd of September was an increase in that number. You go back to the 30th of August, you had about 1,000 detected cases, and that then went up to about 2,600. It's interesting to note that was right around the bank holiday and the Monday, when we had Rishi's Eat Out on the Monday, and that was a huge success, but that actually led to potentially some sense of increase, because it's not just that, it's also the delay over the bank holiday. Now we've seen cases about 3,500 over that two-week period. In fact, it is early enough to start to see rises in deaths, because the lag is about 14 days, and you're right, it's about 3,500 to 4,000. I also want to explain to you, though, what happens in September. We've seen on the RCGP surveillance data a 50% increase in consultations for acute respiratory infection. When you go back to school, when you open up businesses, when we come back off our holiday, there is a highly predictable increase in acute respiratory pathogens. That leads to a near threefold increase in admissions for children in emergency admissions in September alone. So it's important to say you're acting against the backdrop of what happens in September for all acute respiratory pathogens. Out of the 200,000 people who are coming forward, it looks like about 25% of them are asymptomatic when they come forward, and about 150,000 who come forward have some discernible symptoms. Of them, 97% have some other acute respiratory pathogen on board, and about 3,000 to 4,000 have COVID. So it's get the context in place. It's also important to see what's been happening in places like Oldham. Oldham, for instance, over the 7 weeks has been pretty stable throughout. It sort of moved up and down, but it stayed in the top 10. Irrespective of what we've done, actually what's happened in Oldham is the cases have maintained quite a level between about 60, 70 to 100 per 100,000. But it's interesting, Oldham and Rochdale are in the top two, they're in the top 10 of cases right now. But if you go into the Pennine Acute Trust, what you see is there are 22 patients in them trusts. So although we're seeing rising cases, what we're not seeing is its impact in hospitals and deaths. We are seeing a slight increase, but nothing like what we saw in March and April.
Do you have an explanation for that, Professor Hannigan?
Yeah, well, I think, look, there are two things. I think it's right to say at the moment is this is a point in time where we have to consider what's the strategy around our programme from the government. Are we accepting that the virus is endemic? And when you understand endemic viruses that are seasonal, they circulate weekly through summer amongst the young people. And that's exactly what we're seeing now. We also have an issue with understanding what's called the cycle threshold, to understand what viral load of people are accruing. And that's an important aspect which we can talk about later. And then there's the other aspect. When you think about seasonal pathogens, one of the things you've got to be mindful of is you don't push the disease by having delay tactics into the winter when we fare much worse in February, March, and there are a number of reasons for that. Circulating co-pathogens. People have immunity issues. We have issues around our vitamin D that we're researching. But remember, between now and Christmas, we will see a fourfold increase in consultations in general practice in a good year. We will see an eightfold increase in an epidemic year. We will see a 50% increase in deaths between now and January. And the reason I'm giving this information is to provide context.
Thank you. We're grateful for that. We'll drill down into some of the local outbreaks with some of my colleagues who represent some of those regions. But just to pick up finally before I turn to them on some of the implications perhaps of what you said. So if people, especially young people and children, are going to the doctors because they've got symptoms that are associated with September that they don't have in June, July and August, are you suggesting that some of the the increased positive tests comes from the fact that more people are presenting themselves with symptoms for testing than did in July and August, but they might have the same level of infectivity with regard to COVID.
I'm saying for acute respiratory pathogens, now there are more people with other infections on board than COVID. But one of the keys about the detection is when you see rising cases, what you're picking up is what's in the background. That's what the ONS survey data tells us. And it's told us all along in the background, it's three or four times higher than what we were think we were picking up in August. And it was circulating weekly amongst the population. Wherever you go in and test more, you'll start to pick up what's there. And that's what we've seen with the strategy. And so when you focus and go into certain areas, there's been a strategy that said, oh my gosh, it's going up. But actually what you're picking up is what's there. And there's been an overinterpretation with language like exponential rises. That's an incorrect way of looking at the disease. Most of the increase is in line with a seasonal pathogen that's having a linear increase at this time of year.
All right, folks, we'll leave it there. But that is Professor Carl Hennigan. If you want to type him in on YouTube or Google or whatever, you can find out. You can have a listen to him in some of his interviews in their entirety. But he's another guy who's shedding some common sense in this and exposing the government's lies on this whole coronavirus thing. Also, just before I go, might be a good time to look at buying some gold and silver to protect yourself. There's been a little significant dip in the price of both gold and silver over the last 48 hours. Quite dramatic, actually. Silver is down from over £20. Let me do that in dollars. Well, it would have been over sort of like almost $27. It's down now to $22. And gold is down now to less than $1,900. So all I see that is a great opportunity to buy some more, because I think we're in a bull market there, which is going to last for probably 6-7 years. But anyway, folks, I'll be back again next Monday, same time. 2 p.m. Central Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, here on revisionmedia.org with me, Paul Edward Stevenson. I'm on Facebook at Paul Edward Stevenson, and join me live on Republic Broadcasting Network midday, Monday, every Monday midday there, Central Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, with Richard on Beyond the Official Narrative. So take care, and God bless you.